Good afternoon. So, last time we talked about network file systems. So, one particular common case where you want a sort of distributed system is where we wanted to have multiple machines access the same file system, and we have a network file server and other machines were clients for that. And we talked about how we could design the protocol for this network file server. And we mentioned that we have this particular trade-off, which this was a good example of it, but comes across in all sorts of protocols of whether the server was stateful or stateless. If it was stateless, that meant it would not remember things about clients between requests. So in that case, we had this advantage that we didn't have to track things like what files do clients have open. Which means that if a client goes away for a while, we don't have a problem. If a server, crashes and reboots with the same file system, we don't have to worry about whether we recorded what the clients were doing. The clients can be responsible for that. And we saw in this sort of general pattern for making most stateful services stateless, which is that have the client store what the server would store about clients between requests and just send it back. And we saw that, well, there's some things that we just can't really do or do well without a stateful server. And one place where we were definitely making compromises was with caching. So for a network file system, we ideally like it to be the case that if I'm reading a file which hasn't changed for a while, for the 25th time, that I don't need to contact the server every single time. But if the server isn't tracking that we're interested in that file or even who we are, then there's no way that it can really help us with that. We're not probably going to have to talk to the server in order to make sure the cache gets updated just in case. We mentioned that you could make compromises, and NFS version 3 made a particular compromise that it, checked on open if its version was up to date, updated on close, but allowed clients to have their deal with their cached version in the meanwhile to still get acceptable performance without going all the way to having the clients track what files are, sorry, trying having the servers track what files the clients have open, which some other network file systems do some variant of that in order to solve this caching problem more effectively, but at the cost of making things like recovering from failures more complicated. So after we talked about network file system, we moved on to starting talking about security, which we'll finish up today. So we have talked about the idea of protection, which is our mechanisms to restrict access to things, some share important resources, versus security, which was some policy about those resources we wanted to enforce. And we mentioned that we're going to mostly talk about protection, meaning that we're not going to talk about, well, what's the right policy, and so on. And for the most part, what we were concerned about was identifying particular sort of, users or some analogy to users, what programs were allowed to do, and we needed some way of representing what things programs were allowed to access. And the biggest idea we had for that was this idea of access control list that attached to each object. Like a file, and we might use this for other things, like a process that you can kill or something like that. We have what we called an access control list. This could take many forms as far as the particulars, but the fundamental thing is that we would identify some programs via a category, like a user or a group, and what operations were allowed. And to make these work, we needed those categories. And our key mechanism was that we'd have these user or group IDs that each process would be associated with. So if I was running a program, typically it would be associated with a user ID assigned to me. This would just typically be a number. And this would be stored in the process control block. And these would be enforced, sort of, used with the access control list on system call and the system call handlers. So if I tried to open a file, it would check my user ID and my group ID versus the access control list, and that's how that would be enforced. Now, we have this idea of having these user IDs and group IDs and checking them in our system calls, but we needed some way of actually setting them. Yeah. And importantly, the kernel, which actually implemented these checks, typically wouldn't actually know anything about like passwords or other things like that we use to determine, what user is running a program and so on. So we had this mechanism to sort of bootstrap that. And part of that mechanism is we had some super privileged user, sometimes called super user or root, which basically had a special user ID that would bypass most checks. And basically, it would be as if it was on every single access control list. And that user ID would be able to set a different user ID to run a program, and that's how we implement the program where I type my password in, and then I get a shell, for example, running as my user ID. We also needed some mechanism to provide access to sort of special privileged functionality from normal users, where I'd be running something as my user ID, and then I need to do something that my user ID can't do. And POSIX have this very generic mechanism of set user ID applications. That the system administrator would set up a program that does something that requires super user or some more special privileges that I could run, and just set a bit to tell the kernel that, hey, when you run this program, it's okay to run it as super user because I've checked the program very carefully and know that it's not going to allow them to do things I don't want them to do. And this gave us controlled access so we could allow users to do limited things with super user privileges. For example, we might allow users to, mount a USB stick, even though we don't want to give them full access to the mounting disks operation. And I mentioned that, set user ID programs, nice generic mechanism, really flexible, also really hard to use well. And this is because any sorts of bugs in the set user ID applications are huge problems. And because I, when I'm running the set user ID application, can run it in all sorts of strange ways, there's a lot of bugs that are likely to happen, which you don't usually need to think about when you're writing a normal application like, a word processor. And one category of bugs that we mentioned specially that comes up both in set user ID applications and other sorts of security checks where we have things like access control lists was this idea of a time to check to time of use problem. And sort of our example was, what if I was checking, if a user could access a file, then doing something that requires super user with that file, like printing it out on a printer that, I'm making sure and no one prints too many pages and so on. Well, in that case, I have to worry about when I check and when I actually use the file, is it the same file? And, this is a common bug where you don't do this. And our ideal solution was that we could temporarily switch to less privileged user, and let the OS do the check. So this was for the set UID program trying to check. So our solution for set UID programs trying to check, permissions, check, is the user that's running the set UID program allowed to access the file? We have this mechanism, which helps us avoid these problems in that particular case where they could temporarily switch back to my user ID to open the file and then switch to back to root to actually print and therefore make sure the correct checking is done on the same file that they open and not some other file. That was sort of one mechanism that POSIX provided to make it a little easier to write, say, set UID programs. But there's still plenty of problems, And I mentioned this type of vulnerability because it occurs in more than just set user ID application. This is something which is really common when we're thinking about trying to implement things like access control lists. So today I'm going to move on and talk about one last security topic and then talk a little about virtual machines. But before I do that, any questions about the topics from last time? Can I explain what I meant by effective user IDs? Sure. So the user IDs that the ones used for permissions checks in POSIX are the effective. There are others track info about the prior user ID for set UID programs. So there's an effective user ID, that's the important one, and there are some other user IDs for tracking just for set user ID programs, what was the previous user ID. And they exist mainly to support this temporarily switch back to that user operation. Does that answer your question? So our last security topic, we're going to talk about an alternate approach to everything we've seen. And the approach we have seen is that something sometimes called ambient authority, that sort of my process just kind of implicitly has the ability to do a bunch of things. It's ambient, it's in the air around my execution environment. And, you know, that's just based on who I am and not what I'm doing. And there's an alternate approach where we want to say instead that rather than calling open, some secret, and then that, whether I can access that secret is based on this user ID and group, we want to call open, with some token, and this token will me having that token will determine that, yes, I can access the secret thing. And this alternative to having these user and group IDs determine who can access things is something known as capabilities. And sort of our basic idea is that we're going to have a token that identifies a resource that also is permission to access a resource. So rather than using a file name of secret, I'm going to get some sort of token that, identifies the secret file, and me having that token means I can access that file. And the reason why OS designers really like this idea is because this makes it a lot harder to have security bugs related to checking access control lists. We don't have one anymore. And when we get this token that identifies my secret file, I need to look up what the token means to use it. So, and if I know that you can only have the token if you're allowed to access the file, then that means I can't possibly skip the check or do the check incorrectly to see if you can access the file. Now, the problem that you're probably thinking here is, well, if I can't identify my file by a name, this seems awfully useless, not a global name at least. But there are ways of making this sort of system practical. And sort of adding naming on top of it, kind of the same way we added naming to user IDs. Like the kernel doesn't have names for user IDs, but we add them outside the kernel. We can do the same kind of thing with these tokens. And this sort of idea of capabilities exists, if you think about it, in some of our systems we've already seen. So file descriptors is a list of open files you have access to. The token here is the index into your process's file descriptor table. And in POSIX, we typically check all permissions on open. So when we open a file, that's when we check permissions. But once we have a file descriptor, if you have that file descriptor and you open it for writing, you can write. You know, and that's an example of a capability. The file descriptor is a token to access the file. And you having that token and having it be valid means you can read or write the file depending on what's stored in the table. You know, file descriptors. And sort of that means that, you know, it acts like a capability. And when we do reads and writes, we don't actually check the access control list again. We know that was already done when we created the file descriptor. And you can think of page tables the same way. Page tables are kind of a list of physical pages you can access. And the reason you can't access anything you're not supposed to is not because we're checking an access control list to figure out, do you have access to that physical page? It's because if you can't access it, you don't have a virtual page number for it. You don't have a virtual address for that page. And so this common idea for these tokens is that we have a list of what you can access that's stored as a table with your process. So rather than storing user IDs, we store a table of here are the objects you can access. And we can see for file descriptors, this is actually very practical and, you know, pretty elegant, but it works a little less well for other resources. And this is mainly because you think of, well, but I still want to open a file in my home directory. And the main issue with that is you think of, well, how do I do that in this model? It seems like I can't. And typically a solution for this is that we're going to have, you know, ways of getting capabilities from other programs or getting like a capability for a directory and letting that get you a capability for a file in that directory. So there have been systems which sort of expand things to make that work. And I'll go over a brief example of this. But one thing to make this more practical that we don't see in these examples has to do with communicating between processes. When we think about files, I want to be able to write a file in one process and read it from another. And the way I think of doing that is with a file name. I can't pass a file descriptor to a random other program. I can only do that if it's like my child process. And so a common thing that we might want to add is the ability to send these tokens to other processes. So rather than sending a file name, I will communicate with some other process and send a file descriptor and somehow have that end up being opened in the other process. And this is something that most Unix-like systems actually support. They support sending file descriptors over sockets. And this can solve our naming problem. If I want to have, you know, global names for things, I can do this outside the kernel. I can just have everyone have a file descriptor for a server, have that server send other file descriptors based on a name itself using whatever policies it wants. And the kernel doesn't need to worry in that model about access control lists. So capabilities are something where there's some OSs which have been based around this, but to give sort of a concrete example of what this might look like, I'm going to go over an example of adding this to a POSIX-like OS. So there's a research project from Cambridge that took FreeBSD, which is a Unix operating system, and added capabilities. And the idea is that they had this opt-in mode for backwards compatibility where you could require a process to only use capabilities to access anything. So there'd be no name, no global names. You couldn't open /secret because that's a global name. Instead, you always have to have a capability in order, you know, to access an object. And the capabilities they used, they just reused file descriptors. So they had a file descriptor for each thing you'd access. But rather than just having them be for regular files, they also had file descriptors for directories. So if you wanted to like look for a file in a directory, you know, you could do that, but you have to have a capability for the directory, and that's how we controlled whether you could access it. If you had that, yes, you were allowed to use files in that directory. If you didn't, you weren't. If you wanted to, say, kill a process, you need to get a capability for the process, which would be represented as a special type of file descriptor, which you couldn't read or write, but there would be some other operations that were allowed. And to make this useful, rather than just recording, can I read this file descriptor or write it, they have extra permissions, like, can you execute this file descriptor? Can you open files in it if it's a directory? Can you kill it if it's a process? And so on. And to support this, they added a few extra system calls, some of which exist in modern systems, like OpenAt, which is rather than taking a global path, you give a directory that the directory says, yes, you can open things in this, and you get a file descriptor for a file in that directory, or route to exec a program rather than giving the path to the program, you get to have a file descriptor for the program, and you use the special version of exec. And rather than forking and getting a PID, which is a global name, you call this special version of fork, which gives you a token which says, yes, you can kill that process or wait for that process. And this gets rid of global names and therefore, you know, access controllers. So questions on this capabilities idea. So the sort of key security thing, CLs, you know, is that this directory FD and so on, you know, is coupled with, can you access this directory? Can you do X in this directory? And the hope is that this is less error prone because when we look up, you know, when we're looking up this file, rather than needing to check the access control list on the directory, we just see, do you have a valid directory file descriptor? And the answer is yes. Okay, you got it. Okay, so that's where I'm going to finish up on security. And for the rest of today, we're going to introduce virtual machines. And I'm going to talk about one particular way of implementing virtual machines. And we mentioned earlier that we have this sort of notion that, well, OSs really are virtual machines. They just implement this different virtual machine interface. But we're going to talk about how do we implement the system virtual machine interface, namely one that's going to imitate the physical hardware interface. So we're going to think about what things we have to do to have our interface not look like system calls, but look like the real hardware looks. Now, when we imitate the hardware, we're not necessarily going to imitate the hardware we're actually running on. We're going to choose some hardware that exists that's easy to emulate. Okay. So we'll talk about how we do that. And we're going to talk about sort of two big challenges in imitating the real hardware interface. One of this is dealing with exceptions in general and I/O, and the other is dealing with page tables. Now, for talking about this, I'm going to have some terms that I'm going to use that I want to be very clear, because if they aren't, you're going to be really confused in like 1 minute. So one term is hypervisor or virtual machine monitor. This is something that runs system virtual machines which think or have an interface like real hardware. The thing you're running inside the virtual machine we'll call a guest operating system. The thing running the hypervisor or the virtual machine monitor we'll call the host OS. And for simplicity, I'll talk as if the hypervisor is the host OS. And often it's the case that to implement a hypervisor, you're going to need a lot of extra functionality in the host OS. I'm not going to talk about how that might be exposed. The simplest way is that the hypervisor is the host OS. That you make an OS that only runs virtual machines. Obviously, you've used virtual machine monitors, that hypervisors that don't work that way. So in that case, there's going to be a bunch of functionality where the host OS will have to add new system calls and so on. We're not going to talk about exactly what those are. We're just going to talk about what's going to have to happen in the host OS without being specific about whether it's the host OS or the hypervisor doing it. We're just going to kind of lump them together. And when we talk about system virtual machines, there's kind of a spectrum here. So I said we imitate the real hardware. And often when people talk about system virtual machines, they don't quite do that. So there's something we'll call full virtualization, and this is what we're going to focus on today, where we're going to take a guest OS and run it without modifications. There's another option called paravirtualization, where we're going to make small modifications to the guest OS to support virtual machines. So one example is that when we talk about how page tables work, we'll learn that it's really, really ugly if we want to do full virtualization without hardware support. So we might say, let's change the guest OS to fix this, you know, because it's going to be relatively minor. And that's paravirtualization. We're not going to be focusing on that, but it's a common approach. Even with paravirtualization, applications in the guest OS should still be unmodified. And I note that this is not sort of a well-defined term, because things like custom device drivers, sometimes people don't call those paravirtualization, even if, you know, the display driver we're using is talking to a display device controller that doesn't exist physically anywhere, and couldn't exist physically anywhere. And we're going to talk about one way of implementing VMs. And there are a bunch of variations I'm not going to talk about. So I'm only talking about one possible solution. There are others that are out there that I won't mention or won't have time to mention. So one big thing is that you might have extra hardware support. And something we're going to kind of gloss over that's kind of unfortunate is that you kind of need a little extra hardware support on some OS, some architectures, because some things don't work the way you would expect them to. But we're not going to talk about what that looks like because we won't have time. So I'm going to give a model where we don't have extra hardware support, but we happen to have a architecture which is not designed in a way which prevents us from, you know, implementing the right interface without this extra hardware support. Another option is that we could compile the guest OS's machine code to new machine code. So we're going to run the original machine code as is on the hardware in the guest OS, but not run it in kernel mode. But there's this other option where you like compile it to new machine code. You might say, that sounds really slow. Surprisingly, this is actually kind of practical. Okay, so when we're thinking about our virtual machine, so our model is going to be that we have stuff, a hypervisor, which runs a guest OS, which runs a guest OS program, which runs on the real hardware. And this is a conceptual layering. It's conceptual because, as I mentioned, we're going to be running the guest OS's machine code on the hardware, kind of like when I run an application in the normal OS, I run its machine code directly on the real hardware. And this is our conceptual layering. And as far as the hardware is concerned, the hypervisor runs in kernel mode, and all of the guest OS code that ever runs is going to run in user mode. And this here is basically going to be the hypervisor's process that runs in user. Now, the guest OS, we have a problem here. The guest OS is code that is part of the OS. A lot, most of that wants to run in kernel mode. So we're going to have a pretend kernel mode that it's going to run in, and we're going to somehow make that work sufficiently like it were really running in kernel mode. We're also going to have a pretend user mode that it can use that's going to interact with its pretend kernel mode stuff like it would on real hardware. So the hypervisor is going to keep track of everything about this pretend user in kernel mode. So that means that, you know, we're going to keep track of stuff we keep track of for normal processes. This is kind of like a process. So we're going to keep track of the guest OS registers, what its page table is, and so on. Just the same as a normal OS. So we have a question. What's the difference between the guest OS and the host OS? The host OS is... This is the host OS. The host OS is what's running the virtual machine. The guest OS is what's running inside the virtual machine. Does that answer your question? Okay. So the hypervisor needs to keep track of what are the registers the guest OS has. It needs to keep track of its page table and the I/O devices the guest can access. So this so far is actually the same as a normal process running on an OS, except so far. But where things get tricky are we have to keep track of the stuff to implement this pretend kernel mode. So we're going to need to keep track of things that would normally be tracked in the real hardware. Like the guest OS is going to set a page table address. We need to track that. The guest OS is going to have an exception table to know where, you know, if a system call happens, where is its system call handler? We need to track that. And we're going to need to do things to support making the pretend kernel mode seem to work the way the real kernel mode works. And we'll look at what that looks like a bit later. So we have this idea that we're kind of running the OS like a process. And the big thing that we have to worry about is what happens when we're in this pretend kernel mode and the guest OS tries to do something that, you know, on real hardware requires kernel mode. It's not really in kernel mode, so what's going to happen? And the answer about what's going to happen is that it's going to trigger an exception. So, and at least that's our hope. So, you know, hopefully everything that requires kernel mode does this. It turns out that some architectures, it's not true that everything that requires kernel mode, like, just doesn't work in user mode completely. Sometimes they work differently. But assuming that that's the case, then everything the guest OS tries to do that's supposed to happen in kernel mode should trigger an exception. Like, it tries to talk to a device via memory mapped I/O. We're going to have that not be mapped. That will trigger a page fault. It tries to disable interrupts. That's not something we let user programs do because they could hang the system. So it's going to trigger a protection fault. It tries to make a system call. It's going to trigger a system call exception. So all these sorts of things the guest OS will try to do will trigger an exception. And what we're going to do in our hypervisor is we're going to handle these exceptions, but we're going to handle them differently than we would in a normal OS. So when it tries to talk to a device by accessing memory assigned to that device, we're going to talk to the device on its behalf. We might translate it to, you know, a different kind of device, or for example, it might think it's talking to our keyboard, but it's really talking to some kind of software keyboard. But we'll do translate the operation, sort of. So we'll look at the page fault, translate to the real hardware device. So we'll look at what the page fault's trying to do, translate that to a real hardware device. If it tries to disable interrupts, we're not going to disable interrupts on the real machine, but we're going to track that, oh, the hypervisor disabled interrupts, so let's not emulate an interrupt while that's happening. So we'll change a flag for the hypervisor to check later in this case of this, it tries to disable interrupts operation. If it tries to make a system call, then what would happen on a real machine is that, well, it would run the system call handler in the guest OS. So if it tries to make a system call, we're not going to run a system call in the host OS. We'll say, oh, the guest OS was running. Let's run a system call, the guest OS's system call handler. And we have a question, what's the hypervisor in the context of something like VirtualBox? VirtualBox, including all the components it needs under the hood, is the hypervisor. Does that answer your question? Yeah. And as I said, I'm kind of being vague about exactly whether this is done in the OS or in some application running on top of the host OS. But and just the hypervisor is what's running the virtual machine no matter where that code is. So this is going to be our key idea. And so we're going to look at each of the, at, you know, using this idea, and that this idea of an exception happens and we do what the processor would normally do is how we're going to deal with these first two issues. How do we make I/O and other kernel mode related operations work? And we're going to call this solution trap and emulate. So the trap is that the I/O or kernel mode thing triggers an exception because we're in user mode. So it causes a fault, and our fault handler does what the instruction would do. Second thing we're going to have to do is we're going to have to make exceptions and interrupts work. So when the guest OS programs make a system call, it should make a system call in the guest OS, not the host OS. We have to make that happen. And our last topic is going to be making page tables work, which is its own complicated thing. So let's look at this trap and emulate idea. So normally, you know, accessing device memory or other privileged instructions like changing the exception table trigger a fault. And what we've seen previously happen for this, like in our paging assignment, you know, you access memory you're not supposed to, well, we're going to crash it. In the hypervisor, we're going to instead pretend it did the right thing. And what's the right thing? Well, if we're in this pretend kernel mode, we want to do the actual privileged operation, but possibly, you know, translate it. So like if the guest OS tries to write something to the screen, we're going to write to the window, not the screen. If it's in user mode, the right thing to do is to do what would happen on real hardware in real user mode, which is run the exception handler in the guest OS. So how this might work, again, we have our pretend user mode, our pretend kernel mode, and our real user mode. So the guest OS is running some, you know, system call handler that tries to talk to a device. And when it tries to access the device, that's not going to work. So it's going to trigger a protection fault. The hypervisor code will run. It will actually talk to the device on behalf of the guest OS and then update the guest OS's state based on what it got from the device and switch back to running it as if the access happened. Okay, so let's look at what this might look like if we were implementing it. So basically, our trap function to handle this hypervisor case is when we get this exception, we're going to figure out, oh, were you trying to access the keyboard? If so, let me actually translate that into accessing the keyboard, but the way I access the keyboard as the hypervisor is by doing a read, not by like actually talking to the keyboard directly. So we have these operations here. So this operation is read from keyboard. My idea here is that I'm looking at the instruction that triggered the trap and figuring out, is this instruction trying to read from the keyboard? And if so, I do a read system call based on what the registers are set to. You know, kind of translating the device access into a real access. So for example, if you're running XV6, this is the instruction which compiles to this special in instruction that would trigger the protection fault. You're not allowed to do this in user mode. So when our hypervisor is running XV6, it would say, oh, this wasn't allowed. Let's look at this instruction. It's going to figure out, oh, we're trying to access, you know, this keyboard address and read into AL. And we're going to translate that into a read operation. So a more expanded version of this might be that, okay, we got a protection fault. The guest OS thinks it's in kernel mode. It's not really in kernel mode, but it thought it was. And since it thinks it's in kernel mode, we're going to say, okay, it's an in instruction that triggered this protection fault. And the in instruction is trying to read from the keyboard. What we're going to do, therefore, is we're going to update the register that the in instruction would read from and advance to the next instruction. Okay. Questions about this sort of idea of how we're emulating the instruction. So the guest OS does what it thinks should work because it thinks it's in kernel mode, thinks it reads from the keyboard. Our hypervisor code gets the protection fault for trying to do that operation and looks at what it was trying to do. The simplest way is it can just read the machine code to say, okay, it's an in instruction, it's accessing the keyboard, therefore update the register the instruction would run to as if it would access the keyboard, but you know, we're not going to really access the keyboard. We're going to do something else that's equivalent. Questions on, you know, what this exception handler is doing. So exceptions from both the host and guest OS go through the OS kernel, go through the host OS kernel, yes. So this is going to be somehow invoked, you know, this is invoked from the host OS's exception handler somehow. And this is just for any exception on the real hardware. Does that answer your question? And because the host OS is what's running directly on the hardware, it gets all the exceptions. And there's something going on here I'm not pointing out where it knows that, oh, we're running the hypervisor, so we're going to do the hypervisor version of handling the exception. So the question is, wouldn't this slow down the host OS significantly? So the host OS, well, it's going to run the guest OS as fast as it runs it. The guest OS is going to run a lot slower than it would run in real hardware because this is a lot more work than accessing the keyboard controller. And from the host OS perspective, are they different than regular exceptions? So the host OS needs to know that it needs to handle exceptions from the guest OS differently than it would from a normal application. And there are a variety of mechanisms you might imagine for doing that. So one way you might imagine doing it is you'd have like a process control block for the guest OS that has a flag saying, handle this with the hypervisor stuff. And you check that at the beginning of the exception handler. Does that answer your questions? So this is the idea of trap and emulate. When we get this exception, we realize that, wait, if this were really running in kernel mode, it would have accessed the keyboard. So we simulate doing that operation, including simulating the execution of the instruction that would read from the keyboard. And yeah, as pointed out, this is not especially fast, but it works, and that's what's important. So let's think about the case where we have some code running in user mode, which tries to do this same operation. If you do this in user mode normally, then it should trigger a protection fault. So what do we want to do in that case? If our guest OS, you know, thinks it's in user mode, so we're running in pretend user mode, then what we want to do instead is we want to invoke the guest OS's protection fault handler. That we want to behave exactly the same as the real hardware would, and what's the real hardware going to do if some ordinary user program tries to talk to the keyboard? It's going to tell the guest OS, it's going to tell the real OS on the hardware that, hey, what is this program doing? So as simulating that real hardware, we want to say the guest OS thinks it's in user mode, just tell the guest, then tell the guest OS's kernel, you know, that, hey, your user mode thing did something wrong. And we do that the same way the real hardware would by running the guest OS's exception handler. And I showed you this for protection faults, but those are kind of like a weird special case. Like we don't accidentally try to access devices in applications, but this is also how we're going to handle things like system calls. So when a guest OS program, remember running in pretend user mode, this is our pretend kernel mode, makes a system call, that's going to trigger a system call exception. And because we're running as a hypervisor, we're going to, instead of running a system call in the host OS, we're going to update things to run the system call handler in the guest OS. And as part of doing this, we're going to, you know, mark the guest OS as being in its fake kernel mode, update its PB. And one other thing that we're going to see later we have to do is that, you know, because there's different things accessible in kernel mode, we'll have to update the page table and somehow. We'll look at that later. But, you know, a big thing is that we're going to have to set up the guest OS to run its exception handler, you know, kind of on its behalf. So we're kind of delegating, you know, one exception handler to another, you know, because what we're emulating is not sort of the system call itself, but running the system call handler, which is what the real hardware would do. Okay. Now, so we run our system call handler, and then the system call is going to happen. The guest OS is going to run code to do what the system call does. This might do IO, which would be handled via what I showed you before. And after it finishes, it's going to return. And to return, we have this special return from interrupt return from exception instruction in the guest OS's system call handler. And that's an instruction that's not allowed in user mode. And since this is only pretend kernel mode, it's going to trigger an exception fault. And how do we emulate the return from exception instruction? Well, we're going to end up, going back into the user program where the system call happened. So in all these cases, sort of our key idea is that we're emulating what the hardware would do. So one thing we might emulate is accessing an IO device. Another thing we might emulate is running exception handlers and returning from exception handlers. And we're going to do that based on whether the guest OS thinks it's in kernel mode or not and exactly what operation happened. But the key idea of this trap and emulate approach is that we sort of look at what the guest OS was trying to do and, you know, what the hardware would do in that case based on the exception which ran the hypervisor code. So our sort of general code is, you know, most exception types, we just run the guest OS if the guest OS was in user mode. And I showed you an example of with I/O without memory mapped I/O, but we're going to do the same thing I did with that protection fault with page faults. So, but something subtle about this is when a page fault occurs in the guest OS, there are actually two cases. So one case is going to be that it was trying to access some device, in which case we emulate that device. Another case is that it was trying to access something that was really invalid, in which case we want to run the guest OS's page fault handler. And we're going to make that distinction. How do we tell? Well, we look at what triggered the page fault and see, well, was this address something that I didn't map because it's a device, or was it something I didn't map because the guest OS didn't specify what it should be? We'll look about this when we talk more about how page tables work. But first, let's look at this exercise. So let's say we're using this trap and emulate approach, and a guest OS is running a program that makes a system call to write 4 characters to the screen, and the write system call does this by writing 1 character at a time to a memory mapped I/O address. And I'm asking how many exceptions occur on the real hardware. So how many times is the host OS's exception handler running and doing something? Give another 30 seconds. Okay, so most people say 4. Let me do my count. So first, we make a system call. This triggers an exception. We're writing the instruction that makes a system call exception, and exception in real hardware, this is hypervisor handles and switches to guest OS's handler. So this is an exception in the real hardware. The real hardware doesn't know to run the guest OS's system call handler, so the hypervisor is going to do that translation. But that's an exception in the real hardware. Then we have to write a character at a time. So we're doing 4 times. We're writing to a memory mapped I/O address. So this is, each one of these is going to be an exception. This is a, you know, page fault, you know, hypervisor needs to emulate each move, emulates each write. So it thinks it's writing to some sort of display. It's probably actually translating into a window. The hypervisor needs to emulate that. And each time it writes, that's a memory access that has to trigger a page fault for the hypervisor to run, because remember, we're not modifying the guest OS. So that's 4 more. And then sort of the secret one is return from syscall. is probably going to be an exception to go back to have the hypervisor update its state and realize, oh, it's in pretend user mode now, and go back to user mode like the hardware would when we return from an exception. So questions on my answer here? So we have, so this is our trap and emulate approach. So we needed to trap making the system call invoke the right thing, not the thing that real hardware wants to invoke, making the right operation actually talk to the device, not like trigger a page fault, and make the return from system call actually return to the correct location, because the real hardware is not going to do us that for us. So those are our six exceptions that I counted. So this idea of trap and emulate, so this is a really, you know, nice technique in that it handles, you know, dealing with all sorts of privileged operations and allows us to run the GuestOS code natively as long as it's not doing things like I/O and system calls. It runs at full speed without us doing anything. But we have this key assumption that sort of anything that we might want to change or need to emulate will cause an exception. Or we can make sure it causes an exception. So like device IO, we can make cause an exception by just not making that part of the page table valid. Sometimes this has not been possible on some real hardware. So x86, it used to be the case that there were some instructions which didn't cause an exception, but behave differently in user mode and kernel mode, which is really annoying. But assuming that's not the case, which any sane architecture will do, then you can use this technique. Yes, it might be slow because we're simulating things, but it will actually work. Okay, so our last topic for today, which I guess we'll just have a brief overview, is on how do we implement the guest virtual memory. We have normal user instructions we have emulated. We have I/O by, you know, make it trigger an exception and emulate exception handling. We just kind of forward the exceptions to the GuestOS's handler and forward the GuestOS returning from an exception to the right location. But we're missing how do we deal with page tables, virtual memory. So to talk about this, I'm going to need some terms. Because we're going to have two page tables at a time, and that's kind of confusing. So I'm going to use the term virtual address for an address in the GuestOS, physical address for what the GuestOS thinks is a physical address, and machine address for a physical address on the real hardware, a physical address for the hypervisor and the HostOS. And to implement virtual memory without changing the hardware, we need to provide the hardware with a translation from virtual to machine. And we're going to look at that. But what we actually have is, well, the GuestOS is going to set its page table. And we can know what that is because it sets it with a privileged instruction. There's a protection fault. We can emulate that. Our emulation is, rather than setting a real page table, we're going to record, yes, we know what the GuestOS thinks its page table is. And we're going to have our own sign of page table idea because we want to run multiple GuestOS at a time without having them interfere, even though they're using the same physical addresses. But the hardware, it needs this translation. This is what we have to give the hardware because we're running instructions that need to access machine addresses. And how can we tell the hardware what this translation is? The only mechanism we have is a page table. So we're going to have to create a page table for this translation. And we're going to call this the shadow page table. Why is it a shadow page table? Because it's kind of the shadow of the guest page table, that we're going to do some translation of the guest page table into this page table, where basically the hypervisor is going to look at what does the guest think its page table is, and what do I think the actual machine addresses I'm using, and translate it to this shadow page table. And the hardware is only going to know about this page table. The hardware, you know, doesn't actually know we're writing a guest OS. It's just doing what it usually does. And the guest OS, it hasn't changed any of its code. It's running as if on real hardware. All it knows about is this page table. It's guest page table. So this is our idea of a shadow page table. So the question then is, if this is how we're going to provide a page table that works in the real hardware, when do we set this? And this is kind of tricky. How we set it is straightforward from this picture. Once we know what the guest page table is, we look up in there, then we look up in our hypervisor page table, and that's how we set each entry. But when do we update it? And a really annoying thing about this is that the guest OS is going to update its guest page table, and we need that to still work. Now, a solution for this is going to have to do with something that you have to do on the paging assignment that was a major annoyance, namely the TLB. So the TLB is the hardware cache for page table entries. And the TLB is kind of a shadow copy of the real page table, and it has the same problem. When do we update things in the TLB? And we're going to reuse the solution that's used for the TLB in the hypervisor. So even though the shadow page table's, not the same kind of exact same thing, it's still, we have the idea that we have the guest page table and something produced from it, the shadow page table that needs to get updated, just like the real hardware has the real page table and the TLB that needs to get updated. And how does the processor decide when to update the TLB? Well, the way that works on when we're running directly on real hardware is that the processor, always asks the TLB first, and if there's not something in there, it fetches entries. So that's one way it gets updated. If it's not in the TLB, we create it on demand. We don't fill the whole TLB all at once. We just do it as needed. And we're going to imitate this idea to set the shadow page table. Rather than setting it all at once, we're going to fill it on demand, mainly when the guest OS tries to access a page. We're going to check, can I create a page table entry from that given the guest OS's page table? And if so, we're going to update the shadow page table in the same kind of way. Okay. Now, the trickier case is what happens if I have a TLB entry here, for example, and the guest OS changes that. And on the paging assignment, you learn that that isn't automatically synced, and you needed to tell the hardware, hey, wait a moment, I changed something. And this is the hardware interface that's been chosen to make implementing the TLB easier, is that the OS is going to say, wait, I changed something that you have, and explicitly invalidates the when it sets this page table entry. And we're going to be able to take advantage of that with our hypervisor. The guest OS, because it thinks it has a real TLB, is going to try to invalidate things, and we can catch that invalidation. And rather than invalidating something in the real TLB, we can invalidate something in the shadow page table. So this gives us our solution for how we're going to do this conversion. Because we know when the guest OS edits this, it runs an instruction because it's worried about the TLB being out of sync. We're going to piggyback on that as the hypervisor and clear parts of the shadow page table whenever the guest OS informs its fake hardware that the TLB is wrong. And you can kind of think of the shadow page table like a virtual TLB. So just like the TLB is like a cache of, page table entries ready for use. Our shadow page table is kind of a cache of the guest to us page table entries prepared for use. So we can use the same mechanism to update it. And because our real hardware conveniently doesn't require itself to track what's in the real TLB, for our virtual TLB, what changes in the changes for a virtual TLB, we can rely on the guest OS telling us, hey, you know, I'm clearing things. So then our question is, like, how do we know when to clear out old entries? Well, for example, on x86, these are privileged instructions. So that solves our problem. We're going to have an exception happens. And when we emulate that instruction, the way we're going to emulate it is doing this clearing operation. Rather than clearing the just the real TLB, we'll update this shadow page table as a part of that. Okay. So questions on this idea of how of our procedure for updating this shadow page table and generally what the shadow page table is. I realize I just went through that much quicker than I thought I would. So the shadow page table is that translation. Now, one thing we kind of were missing here is that I didn't deal with all the features of the page table. And one big feature our page table has is that the guest OS can have kernel-only pages. And remember that we were actually running the guest OS in user mode on the real hardware, which means to emulate this, these kernel-only pages, when the guest OS is in its pretend kernel mode, we need the shadow page table entry for it to work and be user accessible. When it's in its pretend user mode, we need a shadow page table entry for it to be invalid. And this is kind of annoying because previously when I had a system call, I didn't need to change page tables, and now I do. So one way we might implement this in a hypervisor is we'll have two shadow page tables. We'll have one for user pretend user mode and one for pretend kernel mode. What's the difference between these two? In the pretend kernel mode one, all the kernel pages that for the guest OS are valid and they aren't in the user mode one. And what we're how and the hypervisor is going to switch between these based on whether we're in pretend user mode or pretend kernel mode. And we can do that because we're the one responsible for emulating things like exceptions for the guest OS. So we know when the guest OS goes from pretend user to pretend kernel mode. Okay. And this is a workable solution. And it now means we have four page tables to implement one page table, which is kind of annoying. And another thing which is annoying for the overhead of this is that, you know, we're, you know, not only keeping extra space, we're also switching page tables a whole lot and potentially invalidating TLB entries a whole lot. So let's think of an example of this. So let's say we're using the scheme where we have a separate user and kernel page table, and we switch between them as needed. Let's go through how many page table switches we have. Let's try this exercise. So I want to know how many in the guest. So how many switches is the guest doing, which is also how many there would be if the guest was running directly on real hardware instead of in a virtual machine. And how many are there going to be in the real OS? Give another 30 seconds or so. Okay, so let's start with the number of guest page table switches. So if our guest is like XV6, we have to switch to another program, then switch back to the original, and each of those are page table switches. But when we're, you know, running the system call versus not, that's not a big deal. We can just do that with the same page table because we have a kernel part reserved. Now how about with real switches? So to make the read system call, we need one. This is from the pretend user shadow page table to the pretend kernel shadow page table. And then we have to make the read system call, then we have two, and this is kind of variable, but from one pretend table to one pretend kernel shadow page table to another. Because remember, when we do a context switch, we typically do that in kernel mode. So we're going to switch from one shadow page table to another. It might be the case that the way we implement this is not by really switching, but by clearing out the shadow page table, but the effect is the same. So switch or clear. Effect is the same, that need to get rid of all of that. Then we need to have a third from the other program's pretend kernel shadow page table to user shadow page table, and then back again to run the interrupt handler, because remember the interrupt happens, we have to handle that in kernel mode, which is going to be pretend kernel mode for the guest OS. Kernel. Then we want to switch back to the original program, which is going to be from kernel of other to the kernel of original, and then to return from the system call, we have to do from kernel to the user shadow page table. So we turn two switches into six. So that's not great for overhead, and that's why six and maybe or more if the hypervisor needs a different page table for its trap handler. So one possibility is that maybe we even have to run the hypervisor code that like simulates does the page table stuff with a different page table, then we'd even have more switches. But at least six with this scheme. That's awfully expensive. So while we successfully added virtual machines without the hardware doing anything special, this gives you the case for why you might want the hardware to help you out. That we're doing a whole lot of extra work when we're doing IO. Now, when we're just running the program, there's no extra work, so this is pretty good. So that's where I'll leave off talking about virtual machines. So I just went through sort of probably the simplest way of implementing virtual machines without special hardware support. The key idea was this trap and emulate idea, that we arrange for the guest OS to run in user mode and for its operations to trigger exceptions, and we handle those exceptions not by doing what we do in a normal OS, but by looking at what would the hardware do if the guest OS were running on real hardware and simulating that. And when we're doing this, we track a bunch of extra state, you know, that the hardware usually would track, like page table pointers, whether it's in whether the guest OS thinks it's in kernel mode or not. But that's all with the idea of emulating what the hardware would do. And to implement our page tables, we need to translate the guest OS's page table to this shadow page table that has the mapping the hardware is looking for. So that's where we're going to leave off today. I'll take last questions before I sign off. And next time is going to be final exam review. And I'm just going to take questions during that. So if you don't have questions, there's not going to be anything for me to talk about.